Samuel Beckett's best-known play, Waiting for Godot, began appearing in theaters in both Europe and the United States in the early 1950s. One critic noted, Becker has achieved a theatrical impossibility, a play in which nothing happens yet keeps the audience glued to their seats. This critic continued, once more, since the second act is a subtly different reprise of the first, Beckett has written a play in which nothing happens twice. Some of you are familiar with this play, some not. It's part of a genre that emerged after World War II, mostly in Europe and in some parts of the United States, called the theater of the absurd, in which certain existentialist playwrights set forth what they saw as life's ultimate absurdity in a world that did not have any kind of ultimate meaning or purpose. Waiting for Godot became one of the more popular expressions of that idea. For all of its stark simplicity, it's really a very complex play. I'm sure master's theses, if not doctoral dissertations, have been written on this thing, but I'm just going to give you the 60-second bare-bones version here. Waiting for Godot features these two hobo-like characters called Vladimir and Estragon sitting and sometimes standing beside a road, feeling they can't go anywhere or do anything until the arrival of the mysterious Godot, who will show them the way and give them a reason for moving on. A couple of other characters come along this road, and they claim to have knowledge of this Godot person, but that's about as far as it gets. Each of the play's acts ends with the same bit of dialogue between the two principal characters, which simply goes, well, shall we go? Yes, let's go. But the final stage direction at the end of each act is the same. They do not move. They just keep waiting for Godot to arrive and show them the way along the road, but since this road of life, so to speak, that they're on, has no ultimate guide, these two would-be travelers feel like they can't go anywhere at all. And this is as far as I'm going to go with the content of the play, except to note that its author, Samuel Beckett, claimed that he really didn't mean for this non-existent Godot to be a metaphor for God. In his cranky Irish way, he noted, if I'd wanted Godot to be God, I'd have written a play called Waiting for God. He meant, so he claimed anyway, for his play to be about the futility of living by hope and anticipation alone and of allowing life to pass you by while you're making other plans or waiting for someone, for something, to come along and bring you some kind of deliverance. But the playwright's protestations have not stopped this Godot-God equation or connection from being made, and Beckett himself did acknowledge at some later point after he made that other remark that, well, maybe on some subconscious or unconscious level, he really was writing about the absence of God after all. And Beckett also knew that once you write something like this and put it out there for public consumption, that a variety of interpretations are fair game, whether the writer intended them or not, consciously or not. Well, one of the more fascinating takes I've come across on this play, though, is not found by a drama critic. It comes from one of my colleagues and friends in the Unitarian Universalist ministry, the Reverend Michael Short. Michael has been the minister at the First Unitarian Society in Madison, Wisconsin, for as long as I have been here. We both began our ministries with our present congregations at the same time. Our paths cross from once in a while. And this is his Waiting for Godot story, as he recalls a strongly atheistic household in which he was raised. There was a good deal of routine joking and logic chopping about God in the Schurer house, but the defining moment in our religious lives arrived on Christmas Eve, because that was the time we all sat down in the living room, turned on the hi-fi system, and instead of queuing up a medley of Christmas carols, we laughed at the antics of Vladimir and Estragon as they patiently waited for Godot, the paternal God figure who never appears in Samuel Beckett's famous play. He continues, this was not a convention that I, as a 12-year-old child, resented. On the contrary, listening to Godot made me feel superior to those benighted youngsters who still believed in a cosmic sugar daddy. But then he throws in a punchline here. He goes on to say, nevertheless, it doesn't surprise me that as an adult, my older brother gave his life to Christ and is now active in an Assembly of God congregation. Perhaps it isn't always wise to begin the process of demythologizing too early. A And Schuller rounds up his story with his personal take on the matter, noting that he didn't go quite as far as joining an Assembly of God congregation, but he did become a Unitarian Universalist and then a UU minister. And so he concludes his little story on this note. I'm grateful to be in a movement where belief in God is an option, but not an expectation. A movement where I could be a skeptic one day and a devotee the next. I fervently hope there will always be a place in our liberal religious movement, not only for the theist and the atheist, but also for those who cannot accept theist and atheist as mutually exclusive categories. Well, I don't know Michael real well, and let's say our paths crossed once and again, but I feel a real kind of a spiritual kinship with him when I receive these words, because I too, and you may have picked this up in some of my sermons, I too resonate with that pretty well. I too have a hard time accepting theist and atheist as automatically mutually exclusive categories. For to reject some of the more traditional forms of theism, as I do, does not necessarily make one an atheist. Actually, if you ask me if I believe in God in any kind of a way, my answer will more likely have to do with whatever kind of a day I am having than any kind of theological constructs I may have created for myself. So it is with the stance then of one who, like my friend Michael, moves between being a skeptic and a devotee that I approach the Christmas and the winter holiday season, including what is for Christians the Advent season, which they are now in the midst of. Now, the word Advent, in and of itself, simply means a time of waiting or a time of anticipation. It means waiting or anticipating any kind of a significant or momentous event that you hope will in some way transform your life. In fact, Vladimir and Estragon are actually observing their own version of Advent when they sit by the side of the road, waiting for Godot. Theirs just happens to be an Advent that never comes to any kind of fruition. Contrasting, the Christian Advent is a time of awaiting the arrival of a Savior who will transform the world and the lives that make up the world. So as I say, it is in the matter of being both a skeptic and a devotee, a skeptic and a believer, or moving between them, that I come into this season, and I find myself moving between two contrasting stories, two contrasting mythologies. And I find a certain truth in each one of them, and in the interplay between each one of them, without fully buying into either one of them. So let me run with that for just a minute or two here. The first story, we'll keep this real simple and call it Story 1. Story 1 is the one we've already been looking at. The story of a God or of a greater meaning, call it what you will, who never ever shows up. The other, calling this one Story 2, is the story of a God who actually does arrive. Now both of these stories are myths, and I mean myth in the very best Joseph Campbell sense of the word. Fanciful stories that also contain a truth. Story 2 is about a God, a divine presence, who becomes humanized in the form of a first century Middle Eastern Jewish teacher named Jesus. One who comes heralding the arrival of a time of hope and peace and love and justice. And in some ways, I find stories 1 and 2 equally captivating. Given the way in which I was raised, I encountered Story 2 first, of course, in the home in which I was raised. When I got to college, I came across Story 2 in a modern drama class when we had to read Waiting for Godot. And as I say, I find a certain kind of truth in both of these stories, and in trying to come to terms with them, I sometimes feel like I'm kind of being unfaithful to one or the other. It's like I embrace one story while casting a roving eye on the other story, which I also then go over and embrace while casting an eye back on the other one. So I can embrace Beckett's Story 1 while also looking beyond it. Now, while the mythological accounts of the birth of Jesus are no longer central to my religious and spiritual journey, they still do offer me, from time to time, some traveling companionship, you could call it. For Story 2 is the story of a God who does arrive. But in that story, I do not see the arrival or the advent of what Schuller calls a cosmic sugar daddy who will fix everything for us, but rather some crucial reminders of what it means to be human. Now, the theology that later came to be attached to this story, and some of you who spent those 4 weeks looking at that From Jesus to Christ seminar series probably picked up on this. The theology that later became attached to this story is that this baby, who was born in the midst of rather dangerous and precarious circumstances, and without much of a chance of really making it at all, is also God. Now, I don't even know what that last statement means in any literal sense. But if I bear in mind the aforementioned mythologist, Joseph Campbell, if I bear in mind his caution about not getting too caught up in the literalness of a metaphor, then I can explore a few ways in which the myth of the God-child becomes helpful and instructive. For one of the truths in story 2 of an obscure, just another infant type of baby, who also happens to be God, is, as I see it, a human reminder that that which is often overlooked or ignored or unseen can also be of the greatest importance. It's a reminder that even those, perhaps it's especially those, who are born or raised or find themselves in the most precarious of circumstances, are equally deserving of the opportunity to realize what we UUs call the inherent worth and dignity that they do possess. Now, to be sure, at some point when the child is no longer a child, what he or she does with such an opportunity becomes a matter of personal choice and personal responsibility. But if that divine spark within all of us, to use Ralph Waldo Emerson's real known terms, if that divine spark is not affirmed and not validated at an early age, it becomes harder and harder to realize as time goes by. The second insight I gain from story 2, as I'm calling it, of an anticipated child through whom God arrives, is an affirmation of the power and the potentiality of human life itself. I find it instructive that at the heart of Christian theology is a story. A story of a God who arrives not as a supernatural force for power, but instead, quite simply, as a humble human being who devotes his life and eventually loses his life teaching other human beings how to be more human. That is the sort of humanistic lens through which I see the Jesus story. And some Christians have caught this point, others have not. One of the reasons I find myself attracted to such liberal Christian theologians as Marcus Borg or Harvey Cox, because they really do get it on this point. But be that as it may, what the God-child story suggests to me, seen, as I say, through the lens of a religious humanist, is that all I need when it comes to finding meaning and depth and power and relationship in my life has already been given to me. I may not, indeed I know I have not, and I may not for the course of my life, I know I have not opened up the whole package of possibility for myself. I may never fully do so during my time on earth, but that possibility has been given me nonetheless. And so the story or the myth of a child who embodies God is a way of saying that God actually does arrive, not in Schuller's words again as this cosmic sugar daddy, but as a fellow traveler who reminds us and encourages us with the promise and the understanding that we already have what we need for the journey if we dare use it. The way Jesus put it was to say, the kingdom of God is within you. And once we know that, we can then be up and on our way. So I'm grateful to Samuel Beckett for reminding me in his best-known play of the futility of passively and powerlessly waiting for someone or something to come along and show us the way to bring us some kind of salvation, however defined. And I'm grateful as well for the stories in the New Testament Gospels of Luke and Matthew, because the freedom with which I read them allows me to see that I do not have to wait for what I need, don't have to wait for Godot, as it were, since the fullness of life and living are already available right here on what the poet Edwin Markham called the common human way. And finally, I come into this season of holidays and holy days with the knowledge of expectations that can be both lost and gained. It's far too easy, really, to be cynical, if not despairing, about the promise of the arrival of peace and hope, and joy and love. Those are the four themes of the traditional Christian Advent. It's easy to despair of ever seeing the arrival of the fullness of what another of our UU principles called justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Easy to despair of our ever reaching the level of respect for that interdependent web of life that will actually give us a safe and protected and secure planet to live on. I know it's easy to lose a sense of hope and expectation that things such as these will ever come to be. But at the same time, I also know that sitting beside a road, so to speak, awaiting the arrival of all these great and wonderful things will not and will never bring them into being, not even in any small or measured way. Whatever is to come of our waiting and our hopes and our expectations, whatever is to come of all that remains in our hands and in our hearts alone. And for me, the story or the myth of a God who shows up as a simple human being under very desperate circumstances is just a reminder of that truth. So my suggestion is we take each of these stories, story one and story two, into our minds and into our hearts as we enter into the season now before us. Let us be up. Let us be on our way, believing in all that we can yet bring to pass.